Of all the madmen who tore Chernyshevsky's life into shreds, the worst was his son. Not the youngest, of course, Mikhail, Misha, who lived a quiet life, lovingly working away at tariff questions. He was employed in the railroads department. He had been evolved from his father's positive number and was a good son, for at the time, 1896 to 98, when his prodigal brother, which makes a moralistic picture, was publishing his fantastic tales and a collection of futile poems, he was piously beginning his monumental edition of his late father's works, which he had practically brought to conclusion when he died in 1924, surrounded by general esteem. 10 years after Alexander, Sasha, had died suddenly in sinful Rome, in a small room with a stone floor, declaring his superhuman love for Italian art, and crying in the heat of wild inspiration that if people would only listen to him, life would be different, different. Created apparently out of everything that his father could not stand, Sasha, hardly out of his boyhood, developed a passion for everything that was weird, chimerical, and incomprehensible to his contemporaries. He lost himself in E.T.A. Hoffman and Edgar Poe, was fascinated by pure mathematics, and a little later, he was one of the first in Russia to appreciate the French poet Maudit. The father, vegetating in Siberia, was unable to look after the development of his son, who was brought up by the Pipins, and what he learned he interpreted in his own way, the more so since they concealed Sasha's mental disease from him. Gradually, however, the purity of this mathematics began to irritate Chernyshevsky. And one can easily imagine with what feelings the youth used to read those long letters from his father, beginning with a deliberately debonair joke, and then, like the conversations of that Chekhov character who used to begin so well, an old alumnus, you know, an incurable idealist, concluding with irate abuse. This passion for mathematics enraged him not only as a manifestation of something non-utilitarian. By jeering at everything modern, Chernyshevsky, whom life had outdistanced, would unburden himself concerning all the innovators, eccentrics, and failures of this world. His kind-hearted cousin Pipin, in January 1875, sends him to Vilyuysk an embellished description of his student son, informing him of what might please the creator of Rachmetov. Sasha, he wrote, had ordered an 18-pound metal ball for gymnastics, and what must be flattering to any father. With restrained tenderness, Pipin, recalling his youthful friendship with Nikolai Gavrilovich, to whom he was much indebted, relates that Sasha is just as clumsy, just as angular as his father was, and also laughs as loud in the same treble tones. Suddenly, in the autumn of 1877, Sasha joined the Nevsky Infantry Regiment, but before he reached the active army, the Russo-Turkish War was in progress, he fell ill with typhus. In his constant misfortunes, one is aware of a legacy from his father, who also used to break everything and drop everything. Returning to St. Petersburg, he lived alone, giving lessons and publishing articles on the theory of probability. After 1882, his mental ailment was aggravated, and more than once he had to be placed in a nursing home. He was afraid of space. Or more exactly, he was afraid of slipping into a different dimension. And in order to avoid perishing, he clung continuously to the safe, solid, with Euclidean pleats, skirt of Pelageya Nikolaevna van der Vliet, née Pipin. From Chernyshevsky, who had now moved to Astrakhan, they continued to hide this. With a kind of sadistic obstinacy, with pedantic callousness matching that of any prosperous bourgeois in Dickens or Balzac, he called his son in his letters a big, ludicrous freak and an eccentric pauper, and accused him of a desire to remain a beggar. Finally, Pipin could stand it no longer and explained to his cousin with a certain warmth that although Sasha may not have become a cold and calculating businessman, he had in compensation acquired a pure and honorable soul. And then Sasha came to Astrakhan. Nikolai Gavrilovich saw those radiant, bulging eyes, heard that strange, evasive speech. Having entered the service of the oilman Norbu and being entrusted to accompany a barge load along the Volga, Sasha, en route, one sultry, oil-soaked, satanic noon, knocked the bookkeeper's cap off, threw the keys into the rainbow water, and went home to Astrakhan. That same summer, four of his poems appeared in The Messenger of Europe. They show a gleam of talent. If life's hours appear to you bitter, do not rail against life. For it's best to admit it's your fault you've been born with an affectionate heart in your breast. And if you do not wish to acknowledge even such a self-evident fault. Incidentally, let us note the ghost of an additional syllable in life's hours, matching Zhizn instead of Zhizn, which is extremely characteristic of unbalanced Russian poets of the woebegone sort, a flaw corresponding, it would seem, to something lacking in their lives, something that might have turned life into song. The last line quoted has, however, an authentic poetic ring. The joint domicile of father and son was a joint hell. Chernyshevsky drove Sasha to agonizing insomnia with his endless admonitions. As a materialist, he had the fanatic effrontery to suppose that the main cause of Sasha's disorder was his pitiful material condition. And he himself suffered in a way that he had not done even in Siberia. They both breathed easier when that winter Sasha went away, at first to Heidelberg with the family in which he was tutor, and then to St. Petersburg, because of the need to get medical advice. Petty, falsely funny misfortunes continued to spatter him. Thus, we learn from a letter of his mother's, 1888, that while Sasha was pleased to go out for a stroll, the house in which he was living burned down, and everything that he possessed burned with it. And by now utterly destitute, he moved to the country house of Stranolyubsky, the critic's father. In 1889, Chernyshevsky received permission to go to Saratov. Whatever emotions this might have awakened in him, these were in any case poisoned by an intolerable family worry. Sasha, who had always had a pathological passion for exhibitions, suddenly undertook a most extravagant and happy trip to the notorious Exposition Universelle in Paris, having at first got stuck in Berlin, where it was necessary to send him money in the consul's name with a request to dispatch him back. But no, when he received the money, Sasha made his way to Paris, had his fill of the wonderful wheel of the gigantic filigree tower, and again was penniless. Chernyshevsky's feverish work on huge masses of Weber, which turned his brain into a forced labor factory and represented, in fact, the greatest mockery of human thought, did not cover unlooked-for expenditures. And day after day, dictating, he felt that he could not go on turning world history into rubles. And in the meantime, he was also tormented by the panicky fear that from Paris, Sasha would come crashing into Saratov. On October 11th, he wrote Sasha that his mother was sending him the money for his return to St. Petersburg, and for the millionth time, advised him to take any job and do everything that his superiors might tell him to do. Your ignorant, ridiculous sermons to your superiors cannot be tolerated by any superiors. Thus ends the theme of writing exercises. Continuing to twitch and mutter, he sealed the envelope and himself went to the station to mail the letter. Through the town whirled a cruel wind, which on the very first corner chilled the hurrying, angry little old man in his light coat. The following day, despite a fever, he translated 18 pages of close print. On the 13th, he wanted to continue, but he was persuaded to desist. On the 14th, delirium set in. Inger, ink, nonsense words, then a sigh. I'm quite unsettled. Paragraph. If some 30,000 Swedish troops could be sent to Schleswig-Holstein, they would easily rout all the Danes forces and overrun all the islands, except perhaps Copenhagen, which will resist stubbornly. But in November, in parentheses put the 9th, Copenhagen also surrendered, semicolon. The Swedes turned the whole population of the Danish capital into shining silver, banished the energetic men of the patriotic parties to Egypt, Yes, yes. Where was I? New paragraph. Thus he rambled on for a long time, jumping from an imaginary Weber to some imaginary memoirs of his own, laboriously discoursing about the fact that the smallest fate of this man has been decided. There is no salvation for him. Although microscopic, a tiny particle of pus has been found in his blood. His fate has been decided. Was he talking about himself? Was it in himself that he felt this tiny particle that had kept mysteriously impairing all he did and experienced in life? A thinker, a toiler, a lucid mind populating his utopias with an army of stenographers, he had now lived to see his delirium taken down by a secretary. On the night of the 16th, he had a stroke. He felt the tongue in his mouth to be somehow thick, after which he soon died. His last words, at 3 a.m. on the 17th, were, "A strange business. In this book there is not a single mention of God." It is a pity that we do not know precisely which book he was reading to himself. Now he lay surrounded by the dead tomes of Weber. A pair of spectacles in their case kept getting into everybody's way. 61 years had passed since the year of 1828, when the first omnibuses had appeared in Paris, and when a Saratov priest had noted down in his prayer book, "July 12th, in the third hour of morning, a son born, Nikolai, christened the morning of the 13th before Mass, Godfather, Archpriest Fyodor Stef Vyazovsky." This name was subsequently given by Chernyshevsky to the protagonist and narrator of his Siberian novellas. And, by a strange coincidence, it was thus, or nearly thus, F. V. Blanksky, that an unknown poet signed in the magazine Century, 1909, November, 14 lines, dedicated, according to information which we possess, to the memory of N. G. Chernyshevsky. A mediocre but curious sonnet, which we here give in full. "What will it say, your far descendant's voice, lording your life or blasting it outright? That it was dreadful? That another might have been less bitter? That it was your choice? That your high deed prevailed and did ignite your dry work with the poetry of good and crowned the white brow of chained martyrhood with a closed circle of ethereal light?" Chapter 5. About a fortnight after The Life of Chernyshevsky appeared, it was greeted by the first artless echo. Valentin Linyov, in a Russian émigré paper published in Warsaw, wrote as follows. "Boris Cherdyntsev's new book opens with 6 lines of verse which the author for some reason calls a sonnet, in parentheses, question mark. And this is followed by a pretentiously capricious description of the well-known Chernyshevsky's life. Chernyshevsky, says the author, was the son of a kindly cleric, but does not mention when and where he was born. He finished the seminary, and when his father, having lived a holy life which inspired even Nekrasov, died, his mother sent the young man to study in St. Petersburg, where he immediately, practically on the station, became intimate with the then molders of opinion, as they were called, Pisaryev and Bielinsky. The youth entered the university and devoted himself to technical inventions, working very hard, and having his first romantic adventure with Lyubov Yegorovna Lobachevsky, who infected him with a love for art. After a clash on romantic grounds with some officer or other in Pavlovsk, however, he was forced to return to Saratov, where he proposed to his future bride and soon afterwards married her. He returned to Moscow, devoted himself to philosophy, wrote a great deal, the novel What Are We to Do?, and became friends with the outstanding writers of his time. Gradually, he was drawn into revolutionary work, and after one turbulent meeting, where he spoke together with Dobrolyubov and the well-known Professor Pavlov, who was still quite a young man at that time, Chernyshevsky was forced to go abroad. For a while, he lived in London, collaborating with Herzen, but then he returned to Russia and was immediately arrested. Accused of planning the assassination of Alexander II, Chernyshevsky was sentenced to death and publicly executed. This, in brief, is the story of Chernyshevsky's life. And everything would have been all right if the author had not found it necessary to equip his account of it with a host of unnecessary details which obscure the sense, and with all sorts of long digressions on the most diversified themes. And worst of all, having described the scene of the hanging and put an end to his hero, he is not satisfied with this, and for the space of still many more unreadable pages, he ruminates on what would have happened if. If Chernyshevsky, for example, had not been executed, but had been exiled to Siberia, like Dostoevsky. The author writes in a language having little in common with Russian. He loves to invent words. He loves long, tangled sentences. As, for example, fate sorts, them in anticipation, of the researcher's needs, Or else he places solemn but not quite grammatical maxims in the mouths of his characters, like, the poet himself chooses the subjects for his poems. The multitude has no right to direct his inspiration. Almost simultaneously with this entertaining review appeared that of Christopher Mortus, Paris, which so aroused Zina's indignation that from that time her eyes glared and her nostrils dilated at the very least mention of this name. When speaking of a new young author, wrote Mortus quietly, one usually experiences the feeling of a certain awkwardness. Will one not rattle him? Will one not injure him by a too glancing remark? It seems to me that in the present instance there are no grounds for such fears. Godunov Cherdyntsev is a novice, true, but a novice endowed with extreme self-confidence, and to rattle him is probably no easy matter. I do not know whether his book presages any future achievements or not, but if this is a beginning, it cannot be called a particularly reassuring one. Let me qualify this. Strictly speaking, it is completely unimportant whether Godunov Cherdyntsev's effort is creditable or not. One man writes well, another badly, and everyone is awaited at the end of the road by the theme, which none can evade. It is a question, I think, of something quite different. That golden time has passed irretrievably, when the critic or reader could be interested above all by the artistic quality or exact degree of talent of a book. Our émigré literature, I'm speaking of genuine, undoubted literature, people of faultless taste will understand me, has become plainer, more serious, drier. At the expense of art, perhaps, but in compensation producing, in certain poems by Tsipovich and Boris Barsky, and in the prose of Karidonov, sounds of such sorrow, such music, and such hopeless heavenly charm, that in truth it is not worth regretting what Lermontov called the dull songs of the earth. In itself, the idea of writing a book about an outstanding public figure of the 60s contains nothing reprehensible. One sits down and writes it. Fine. It comes out. Fine. Worse books than that have come out, but the author's general mood, the atmosphere of his thinking, fills one with queer and unpleasant misgivings. I will refrain from discussing the question, how appropriate is the appearance of such a book at the present time? After all, no one can forbid a person to write what he pleases. But it seems to me, and I am not alone in feeling this, that at the bottom of Godunov Cherdyntsev's book there lies something which is in essence profoundly tactless, something jarring and offensive. It is his right, of course, although even this could be questioned, to take this or that attitude toward the men of the 60s, but in debunking them, he cannot but awake in any sensitive reader surprise and disgust. How irrelevant all this is! How inopportune! Let me define my meaning. The fact that it is precisely now, precisely today, that this tasteless operation is being performed is in itself an affront to that significant, bitter, palpitating something which is ripening in the catacombs of our era. Oh, of course, the men of the 60s, and in particular Chernyshevsky, expressed in their literary judgments much that was mistaken and perhaps ridiculous. Who is not guilty of this sin? And is it such a big sin, after all? But in the general intonation of their criticism, there transpired a certain kind of truth, a truth which, no matter how paradoxical it seems, has become close and comprehensible to us precisely today, precisely now. I am talking not of their attacks on bribe-takers, nor of the emancipation of women. That, of course, is not the point. I think I shall be properly understood, insofar as another can be understood, if I say that in some final and infallible sense, their and our needs coincide. Oh, I know, we are more sensitive, more spiritual, more musical than they were, and our final aim, beneath that resplendent black sky under which life streams on, is not simply the commune or the overthrow of the despot. But to us, as to them, Nekrasov and Lermontov, especially the latter, are closer than Pushkin. I shall take just this simplest of examples because it immediately clarifies our affinity, if not kinship, with them. That chilliness, that foppishness, that irresponsible quality they sensed in a certain part of Pushkin's poetry is perceptible to us too. One may object that we are more intelligent, more receptive. All right, I agree. But essentially, it is not a question of Chernyshevsky's rationalism, or Bielinsky's, or Dobrolyubov's, names and dates do not matter, but of the fact that then as now, spiritually progressive people understood that mere art and the lyre were not a sufficient pabulum. We, their refined and weary grandchildren, also want something that is above all human. We demand the values which are essential to the soul. This utilitarianism is more elevated, perhaps, than theirs, but in some respects it is more urgent even than the one they preached. I have digressed from the immediate theme of my article, but then sometimes one can express one's opinion with much more exactitude and authenticity by wandering around the theme in its fertile environs. As a matter of fact, the analysis of any book is awkward and pointless, and moreover, we are interested not in the way an author executed his task, nor even in the task itself, but only in the author's attitude toward it. And let me add this. Are they really so necessary, these excursions into the realm of the past, with their stylized squabbles and artificially vivified way of life? Who wants to know about Chernyshevsky's relations with women? In our bitter, tender, ascetic times, there is no place for this kind of mischievous research, for this idle literature, which anyway is not devoid of a certain arrogant audacity that is bound to repel even the most well-disposed of readers. After this, reviews poured. Professor Anuchin of Prague University, a well-known public figure, a man of shining moral purity and of great personal courage, the same Professor Anuchin who in 1922, not long before his deportation from Russia, when some revolvered leather jackets had come to arrest him but became interested in his collection of ancient coins and was slow in taking him away, had calmly said, pointing to his watch, "Gentlemen, history does not wait," printed a detailed analysis of the life of Chernyshevsky in an émigré magazine appearing in Paris. "Last year," he wrote, "a remarkable book came out by Professor Otto Lederer of Bonn University, Three Despots, Alexander the Misty, Nicholas the Chill, and Nicholas the Dull. Motivated by a passionate love for the freedom of the human spirit and a burning hatred for its oppressors, Dr. Lederer, in certain of his appraisals, was unjust, taking no account at all, for instance, of that national Russian fervor which so powerfully gave body to the symbol of the throne. But excessive zeal, and even blindness, in the process of exposing evil, is always more understandable and forgivable than the least mockery, no matter how witty it may be, of that which public opinion feels to be objectively good. However, it is precisely this second road the road of eclectic mordancy that has been chosen by Mr. Godunov Cherdintsev in his interpretation of the life and works of N.G. Chernyshevsky. The author has undoubtedly acquainted himself thoroughly and in his own way conscientiously with his subject. Undoubtedly also he has a talented pen. Certain ideas he puts forward and juxtapositions of ideas are undoubtedly shrewd. But with all this, his book is repellent. Let us try to examine calmly this impression. A certain epoch has been taken, and one of its representatives chosen. But has the author assimilated the concept of epoch? No. First of all, one senses in him absolutely no consciousness of that classification of time, without which history turns into an arbitrary gyration of multicolored spots, into some kind of impressionistic picture with a walking figure upside down against a green sky that does not exist in nature. But this device, which destroys, by the way, any scholarly value of the work in question, in spite of its swaggering erudition, does not, nevertheless, constitute the author's chief fault. His chief fault is in the manner in which he portrays Chernyshevsky. It is completely unimportant that Chernyshevsky understood less about questions of poetry than a young aesthete of today. It is completely unimportant that in his philosophical conceptions Chernyshevsky kept aloof from those transcendental subtleties which please Mr. Godunov Cherdintsev. What is important is that whatever Chernyshevsky's views may have been on art and science, they represented the Weltanschauung of the most progressive men of his era, and were, moreover, indissolubly linked with the development of social ideas, with their ardent, beneficial, activating force. It is in this aspect, in this sole true light, that Chernyshevsky's system of thought acquires a significance which far transcends the sense of those groundless arguments, unconnected in any way with the epoch of the 60s, which Mr. Godunov Cherdintsev uses in venomously ridiculing his hero. But he makes fun not only of his hero, he also makes fun of his reader. How else can one qualify the fact that among the well-known authorities on Chernyshevsky, a non-existent authority is cited to whom the author pretends to appeal? In a certain sense, it would be possible, if not to forgive, then at least to understand scientifically the scoffing at Chernyshevsky, if Mr. Godunov Cherdintsev were a heated supporter of those whom Chernyshevsky attacked. It would at least be a point of view, and reading the book, the reader would make a constant adjustment for the author's partisan approach, in that way arriving at the truth. But the pity is that with Mr. Godunov Cherdintsev there is nothing to adjust to, and the point of view is everywhere and nowhere. Not only that, but as soon as the reader, as he descends the course of a sentence, thinks he has at last sailed into a quiet backwater, into a realm of ideas which may be contrary to those of Chernyshevsky, but are apparently shared by the author, and therefore can serve as a basis for the reader's judgment and guidance, the author gives him an unexpected fillip and knocks the imaginary prop from under him, so that he is once more unaware as to whose side Mr. Godunov Cherdintsev is on in his campaign against Chernyshevsky, whether he's on the side of the advocates of art for art's sake, or of the government, or of some other of Chernyshevsky's enemies whom the reader does not know. As far as jeering at the hero himself is concerned, here the author passes all bounds. There is no detail too repulsive for him to disdain. He will probably reply that all these details are to be found in the diary of the young Chernyshevsky. But there, they are in their place, in their proper environment, in the correct order and perspective, among many other thoughts and feelings which are much more valuable. But the author has fished out and put together precisely these, as if someone had tried to restore the image of a person by making an elaborate collection of his combings, fingernail parings, and bodily excretions. In other words, the author is sneering throughout the whole of his book at the personality of one of the purest and most valorous sons of liberal Russia, not to speak of the passing kicks with which he rewards other progressive Russian thinkers, a respect for whom is in our consciousness an immanent part of their historical essence. In his book, which lies absolutely outside the humanitarian tradition of Russian literature, and therefore outside literature in general, there are no factual untruths. If one does not count the fictitious Stranolyubsky already mentioned, two or three doubtful details and a few slips of the pen. But that truth which it contains is worse than the most prejudiced lie. For such a truth goes in direct contradiction to that noble and chaste truth, an absence of which deprives history of what the great Greek called tropotos, which is one of the inalienable treasures of Russian social thought. In our day, thank God, books are not burned by bonfire. But I must confess that if such a custom were still in existence, Mr. Godunov-Cherdyntsev's book could justifiably be considered the first candidate for fueling a public square. After that, Koncheyev had his say in the literary annual The Tower. He began by drawing a picture of flight during an invasion or an earthquake, when the escapers carry away with them everything that they can lay hands on, someone being sure to burden himself with a large framed portrait of some long-forgotten relative. Just such a portrait, wrote Koncheyev, is for the Russian intelligentsia the image of Chernyshevsky, which was spontaneously but accidentally carried away abroad by the émigrés, together with other more useful things. And this is how Koncheyev explained the stupefaction occasioned by the appearance of Fyodor Konstantinovich's book. Somebody suddenly confiscated the portrait. Further on, having finished once and for all with the considerations of an ideological nature, and embarked upon an examination of the book as a work of art, Koncheyev began to praise it in such a way that, as he read the review, Fyodor felt a burning radiance forming around his face and quicksilver racing through his veins. The article ended with the following. Alas, among the immigration, one will hardly scrape up a dozen people capable of appreciating the fire and fascination of this fabulously witty composition. And I would maintain that in today's Russia you could not find even one to appreciate it if I had not happened to know of the existence of two such people, one living on the north bank of the Neva, and the other somewhere in distant Siberian exile. The monarchist organ, The Throne, devoted to the life of Chernyshevsky a few lines in which it pointed out that any sense or value in the unmasking of one of the ideological mentors of Bolshevism was completely undermined by the cheap liberalizing of the author, who goes wholly over to the side of his sorry but pernicious hero as soon as the long-suffering Russian Tsar finally has him safely tucked away. And in general, added the reviewer, Pyotr Levchenko, it is high time one ceased writing about so-called cruelties of the Tsarist regime with regard to pure souls who are of no interest to anybody. The Red Freemasonry will only rejoice over Count Godunov-Cherdyntsev's work. It is lamentable that the bearer of such a name should engage in hymning social ideals which have long since turned into cheap idols. The pro-communist Russian language daily in Berlin, UP, this was the one which Vasilyev's Gazeta invariably termed the reptile, had an article devoted to the celebration of the centenary of Chernyshevsky's birth, and concluded thus: they have also bestirred themselves in our blessed emigration. A certain Godunov-Cherdyntsev, with swashbuckling brashness, has hurried to concoct a booklet, for which he has dragged in material from all over the place, and has given out his vile slander as The Life of Chernyshevsky. Some Prague professor or other has hastened to find this work talented and conscientious, and everyone chummily joined in. It is dashingly written, and in no way differs in its internal style from Vasilyev's leaders about the imminent end of Bolshevism. The last dig was particularly amusing in view of the fact that in his Gazeta, Vasilyev resolutely opposed the slightest reference to Fyodor's book, telling him honestly, although the other had not asked, that had he not been on such friendly terms with him, he would have printed a devastating review. Not even a damp spot would have remained of the author of The Life of Chernyshevsky. In short, the book found itself surrounded by a good, thundery atmosphere of scandal, which helped sales. And at the same time, in spite of the attacks, the name of Godunov-Cherdyntsev immediately came to the fore, rising over the motley storm of critical opinion in full view of everyone, vividly and firmly. But there was one man whose opinion Fyodor was no longer able to ascertain. Alexander Yakovlevich Chernyshevsky had died not long before the book appeared. When the French thinker de Lalande was asked at somebody's funeral why he did not uncover himself, ne se découvre pas, he replied, I am waiting for death to do it first. Qu'elle se découvre la première. There is a lack of metaphysical gallantry in this, but death deserves no more. Fear gives birth to sacred awe. Sacred awe erects a sacrificial altar. Its smoke ascends to the sky, there assumes the shape of wings, and bowing fear addresses a prayer to it. Religion has the same relation to man's heavenly condition that mathematics has to his earthly one. Both the one and the other are merely the rules of the game. Belief in God and belief in numbers. Local truth and truth of location. I know that death in itself is in no way connected with the topography of the hereafter, for a door is merely the exit from the house and not a part of its surroundings like a tree or a hill. One has to get out somehow. But I refuse to see in a door more than a hole and a carpenter's job. De Lalande, Discours sur les ombres, page 45. And then again, the unfortunate image of a road to which the human mind has become accustomed, life as a kind of journey, is a stupid illusion. We are not going anywhere. We are sitting at home. The other world surrounds us always and is not at all at the end of some pilgrimage. In our earthly house, windows are replaced by mirrors. The door, until a given time, is closed, but air comes in through the cracks. For our stay-at-home senses, the most accessible image of our future comprehension of those surroundings which are due to be revealed to us with the disintegration of the body is the liberation of the soul from the eye sockets of the flesh and our transformation into one complete and free eye, which can simultaneously see in all directions, or, to put it differently, a supersensory insight into the world accompanied by our inner participation. Ibidem, page 64. But all this is only symbols, symbols which become a burden to the mind as soon as it takes a close look at them. Is it not possible to understand more simply, in a way more satisfying to the spirit, without the aid of this elegant atheist, and equally without the aid of popular faiths? For religion subsumes a suspicious facility of general access that destroys the value of its revelations. If the poor in spirit enter the heavenly kingdom, I can imagine how gay it is there. I've seen enough of them on earth. Who else makes up the population of heaven? Swarms of screaming revivalists, grubby monks, lots of rosy, short-sighted souls of more or less Protestant manufacture. What deathly boredom! I am running a high temperature for the fourth day now and can no longer read. Strange, I used to think before that Yasha was always near me, that I had learned to communicate with ghosts, but now, when I'm perhaps dying, this belief in ghosts seems to me something earthly, linked with the very lowest earthly sensations, and not at all the discovery of a heavenly America. Somehow simpler. Somehow simpler. Somehow at once. One effort, and I'll understand all. The search for God. The longing of any hound for a master. Give me a boss, and I shall kneel at his enormous feet. All this is earthly. Father, headmaster, rector, president of the board, tsar, God. Numbers, numbers. And one wants so much to find the biggest number, so that all the rest may mean something and climb somewhere. No, that way you end up in padded dead ends, and everything ceases to be interesting. Of course I am dying. These pinchers behind and this steely pain are quite comprehensible. Death steals up from behind and grasps you by the sides. Funny that I've thought of death all my life, and if I have lived only in the margin of a book I have never been able to read. Now, who was it? Oh, years ago in Kiev. Goodness, what was his name? Would take out a library book in a language he didn't know, make notes in it, and leave it lying about so visitors would think he knows Portuguese, Aramaic. Ich habe dasselbe getan. Happiness, sorrow, exclamation marks en marge, while the context is absolutely unknown. A fine affair. It is terribly painful to leave life's womb. The deathly horror of birth. L'enfant qui naît ressent les affres de sa mère. My poor little Yasha. It is very queer that in dying I get further away from him, when the opposite should have been true, ever nearer and nearer. His first word was mucha, a fly. And immediately afterwards, there was a telephone call from the police to come and identify the body. How will I leave him now, in these rooms? He will have nobody to haunt, because she would not notice. Poor girl, how much? 5,800, plus that other money, which makes, let me see. And afterwards, David might help, but then he might not. In general, there's been nothing in life except getting ready for an examination, which all the same nobody can get ready for. Dreadful is death to man and might alike. Will all my friends go through it? Incredible. Eine alte Geschichte. The name of a film Sandra and I went to see the day before his death. Oh, no, under no circumstances. She can keep talking about it as much as she pleases. Was it yesterday that she talked about it? Or ages ago? No, they won't be taking me to any hospital. I'll lie here. I've had enough of hospitals. It would mean to go mad again just before the end. No, I'll stay here. How difficult it is to turn one's thoughts over. Like logs. I feel much too ill to die. What did he write his book about, Sandra? Well, tell me. You should remember. We talked about it once, about some priest, no? Oh, you never... anything bad, difficult. After this, he hardly spoke, having fallen into a twilight condition. Fyodor was admitted to him and forever remembered the white bristle on his sunken cheeks, the dull shade of his bald head, and the hand crusted with gray eczema stirring like a crawfish on the sheet. The following day he died, but before that he had a moment of lucidity, complaining of pains, and then saying, it was darkish in the room because of the lowered blinds, what nonsense. Of course there is nothing afterwards. He sighed, listened to the trickling and drumming outside the window, and repeated with extreme distinctness, there is nothing. It is as clear as the fact that it is raining. And meanwhile, outside the spring sun was playing on the roof tiles, the sky was dreamy and cloudless, the tenant upstairs was watering the flowers on the edge of her balcony, and the water trickled down with a drumming sound. In the window of the morticians on the corner of Kaiser Allee, there was exhibited as an enticement, just as Cook's exhibits a Pullman model, a miniature crematorium interior, rows of little chairs before a little pulpit, little dolls sitting on them the size of a bent auricular finger, and in front and somewhat apart, one could recognize the little widow by the square inch of handkerchief she had raised to her face. The German seductivity of this model had always amused Fyodor, so that now it was somewhat disgusting to enter a real crematorium, where from beneath laurels in tubs a real coffin with a real body was lowered to the sounds of heavyweight organ music into exemplary nether regions right into the incinerator. Madame Chernyshevsky did not hold a handkerchief, but sat motionless and straight, her eyes shimmering through the black crepe veil. The faces of friends and acquaintances bore the guarded expressions usual in such cases, a mobility of the pupils accompanied by a certain tension in the muscles of the neck. The lawyer Charsky sincerely blew his nose. Vasilyev, who as a public figure had had a great deal of funeral experience, carefully followed the parson's pauses. Alexander Yakovlevich had turned out at the last minute to be a Protestant. Engineer Kern flashed the lenses of his pince-nez impassively. Gurjainov repeatedly freed his fat neck from its collar, but did not go so far as to clear his throat. The ladies who had used to visit the Chernyshevskys all sat together. The writers also sat together, Lishnevsky, Shachmatov, and Shirin. There were many people whom Fyodor did not know, for instance, a prim gentleman with a blonde little beard and unusually red lips, a cousin, it seemed, of the dead man, and also some Germans with top hats on their knees, who tactfully sat in the back row. Upon the conclusion of the service, the mourners, according to the scheme of the crematorium's master of ceremonies, were supposed to go up to the widow one at a time and offer words of condolence. But Fyodor resolved to avoid this and went out onto the street. Everything was wet, sunny, and somehow nudely bright. On a black football field trimmed with young grass, schoolgirls in shorts were doing calisthenics. Behind the crematorium's shiny gutta-percha gray dome, one could see the turquoise turrets of a mosque, and on the other side of the square gleamed the green cupolas of a white Pskovan-type church, which had recently grown up out of the corner house, and thanks to architectural camouflage seemed almost detached. On a terrace by the entrance of the park, two badly wrought bronze boxers, also recently erected, had frozen in attitudes that completely disagreed with the reciprocal harmony of pugilism. Instead of its collected, crouched, round-muscled grace, there were two naked soldiers scrapping in a bathhouse. A kite being flown from an open space behind some trees made a red little rhombus high in the blue sky. With surprise and vexation, Fyodor noticed that he was unable to keep his thoughts on the image of the man who had just been reduced to ashes and gone up in smoke. He tried to concentrate, to imagine to himself the recent warmth of their live relationship. But his soul refused to budge, and lay there, sleepy eyes shut, content with its cage. The braked line from King Lear, consisting entirely of five nevers, that was all he could think of. "And so I'll never see him again," he told himself unoriginally. But this thin goad snapped without displacing his soul. He tried to think about death, but reflected instead that the soft sky, edged on one side with a long cloud like a pale and tender border of fat, would have resembled a slice of ham had the blue been pink. He tried to imagine some kind of extension of Alexander Yakovlevich beyond the corner of life, but at the same time could not help noticing through the window of a cleaning and pressing shop near the Orthodox Church a worker with devilish energy and an excess of steam, as if in hell, torturing a pair of flat trousers. He tried to confess something to Alexander Yakovlevich, and repent at least for the cruel, mischievous thoughts he had fleetingly had, concerning the unpleasant surprise he was preparing for him with his book. And suddenly he recalled a vulgar triviality, how Shchogolev had once said in some connection or other, "When good friends of mine die, I always think that up there they will do something to improve my destiny here." He was in a troubled and obscured state of mind, which was incomprehensible to him, just as everything was incomprehensible, from the sky to that yellow tram rumbling along the clear track of the Hohenzollern-Damm, along which Yasha had once gone to his death. But gradually his annoyance with himself passed, and with a kind of relief, as if the responsibility for his soul belonged not to him but to someone who knew what it all meant, he felt that all this skein of random thoughts, like everything else as well, the seams and sleaziness of the spring day, the ruffle of the air, the coarse, variously intercrossing threads of confused sounds, was but the reverse side of a magnificent fabric, on the front of which there gradually formed and became alive images invisible to him. He found himself by the bronze boxes. In the flower beds around them rippled pale, black-blotched pansies, somewhat similar facially to Charlie Chaplin. He sat on a bench where once or twice at night he had sat with Zena, for of late a kind of restlessness had carried them far beyond the bounds of the dark, quiet lane where they had at first sought shelter. Nearby, a woman sat knitting. Next to her, a small child, entirely clothed in light blue wool, ending above in the pompon of a cap and below in foot straps, was ironing the bench with a toy tank. Sparrows twittered in the bushes, and from time to time made concerted raids on the turf, on the statues. A sticky smell came from the poplar buds, and far beyond the square, the domed crematorium now had a sated, clean-licked look. From a distance, Fyodor could see tiny figures dispersing. He could even make out someone leading Alexandra Yakovlevna to a toy automobile. Tomorrow he would have to call on her, and a group of her friends gathering at the tram stop. He saw them concealed for a moment by the immobilized tram, and then, with legerdemain magic, they were gone when the shutter was removed. Fyodor was about to walk home when a lisping voice called him from behind. It belonged to Shirin, author of the novel The Hoary Abyss, with an epigraph from the Book of Job, which had been received very sympathetically by the émigré critics. O Lord, our Father, down Broadway in a feverish rustle of dollars, hetairas and businessmen in spats, shoving, falling, and out of breath, were running after the golden calf, which pushed its way, rubbing against walls between the skyscrapers, then turned its emaciated face to the electric sky and howled. In Paris, in a low-class dive, the old man Lachaise, who had once been an aviation pioneer, but was now a decrepit vagabond, trampled under his boots an ancient prostitute, Boule de Suif. Oh, Lord, why? Out of a Moscow basement, a killer came out, squatted by a kennel, and began to coax a shaggy pup. Little one, he repeated, little one. In London, lords and ladies danced the jimmy and imbibed cocktails, glancing from time to time at a platform where at the end of the 18th ring a huge negro had laid his fair-haired opponent on the carpet with a knockout. Amid arctic snows, the explorer Ericsson sat on an empty soapbox and thought gloomily, the pole or not the pole. Ivan Chervyakov carefully trimmed the fringe of his only pair of pants. O Lord, why dost thou permit all this? Shirin himself was a thick-set man with a reddish crew-cut, always badly shaved and wearing large spectacles, behind which, as in two aquariums, swam two tiny, transparent eyes, which were completely impervious to visual impressions. He was blind like Milton, deaf like Beethoven, and a blockhead to boot. A blissful incapacity for observation, and hence complete uninformedness about the surrounding world, and a complete inability to put a name to anything, is a quality quite frequently met with among the average Russian literati, as if a beneficent fate were at work refusing the blessing of sensory cognition to the untalented, so that they will not wantonly mess up the material. It happens, of course, that such a benighted person has some little lamp of his own glimmering inside him, not to speak of those known instances in which, through the caprice of resourceful nature that loves startling adjustments and substitutions, such an inner light is astonishingly bright, enough to make the envy of the ruddiest talent. But even Dostoevsky always brings to mind somehow a room in which a lamp burns during the day. As he walked now across the park with Shirin, Fyodor derived disinterested pleasure from the amusing thought that he had for companion a deaf and blind man with blocked nostrils who regarded this state with complete indifference, although he was not averse at times to sighing naively about the intellectual's alienation from nature. Recently, Lishnevsky had related that Shirin had arranged to meet him about some business in the zoological garden, and when after an hour's conversation Lishnevsky had casually drawn his attention to a hyena in its cage, it transpired that Shirin had hardly realized that one keeps animals in a zoological garden. And glancing briefly at the cage, he had remarked automatically, "Yes, the likes of us don't know much about the animal world," and immediately continued discussing that which particularly disturbed him in life, the activities and composition of the Committee of the Society of Russian Writers in Germany. And now he was in an extreme degree of agitation, since a certain event had come to a head. Chairman of the committee was Georgi Ivanovich Vasiliev, and for this, of course, there were good reasons. His pre-Soviet reputation, his many years of editorial activity, and, most important, that inexorable, almost awesome honesty for which his name was famous. On the other hand, his bad temper, polemical harshness, and, despite great public experience, complete ignorance of people, not only did not harm this honesty, but on the contrary imparted a certain tang to it. Shirin's dissatisfaction was directed not against him, but against the five remaining members of the committee. First, because not one of them, as two-thirds, incidentally, of the whole membership of the society, was a professional writer, and secondly, because three of them, including the treasurer and the vice president, were, if not scoundrels, as the partial Shirin maintained, then at least shade lovers in their bashful but deft activities. For some time past now, a rather comical, in Fyodor's opinion, and absolutely outrageous, in Shirin's terminology, affair, had been going on with the union's funds. Every time a member asked for a loan or a grant, the difference between which was about the same as that between a 99-year lease and life ownership, one had to track down these funds, which at the least attempt to catch up with them became amazingly fluid and ethereal, as if they were always situated equidistantly between three points represented by the treasurer and two members of the committee. The chase was complicated by the fact that for a long time now, Vasiliev had not been on speaking terms with these three members, refusing even to communicate with them in writing, and in recent times had been dispensing loans and grants out of his own pocket, leaving others to get the money from the union to repay him. In the end, the money would be extracted in dribs and drabs, but then it usually turned out that the treasurer had borrowed it from an outsider, so that transactions never caused any change in the phantasmal state of the exchequer. Lately, members of the society who appealed particularly often for aid had begun to grow visibly nervous. A general meeting had been called for next month, and Shirin had prepared for it a plan of resolute action. "There was a time," he said, striding down a path in the park with Fyodor and automatically following its cunningly unobtrusive convolutions, "there was a time when all the people who went on the committee of our union were highly respectable, like Patyagin, Ivan Lushin, Tsilanov, but some died and others are in Paris. Somehow, Gorman oozed through into it and then gradually pulled his pals in. For this trio, the passive participation of the extremely decent, I'm saying nothing, but completely inert Kern and Goryanov is a convenient cover, a kind of camouflage. And Gorman's strained relations with Georgi Ivanovich is a guarantee of inactivity on his part also. The ones to blame for all this are us, the members of the union. If it were not for our idleness, carelessness, lack of organization, indifferent attitude to the union, and flagrant impracticality in social work, it would never have happened that Gorman and his chums from year to year elected either themselves or else people congenial to them. It is time to put an end to this. Their list, as always, will be circulated at the coming elections, but we will then put out our own, 100% professional, President Vasiliev, Vice President Getz, members of the board Lishnevsky, Shakhmatov, Vladimirov, you and I, and then we'll reconstitute the inspection committee. The more so since Bielenki and Chernyshevsky have dropped out. Oh, no, please, said Fyodor, admiring in passing Shirin's definition of death. Don't count on me. I never went and never will go on any committee. Stop it, exclaimed Shirin, frowning. That's not fair. On the contrary, very fair. And anyway, if I'm a member of the union, it's only out of absent-mindedness. To tell the truth, Koncheyev is right to stand aside from all this. Koncheyev, said Shirin angrily. Koncheyev is an absolutely useless handicraftsman working on his own and is completely devoid of any general interests. But you ought to be interested in the fate of the union, if only because you, excuse my directness, borrowed money from it. That's just it. You can see for yourself that if I go on the committee, I shan't possibly be able to give handouts to myself. Bosh, why not? It's a completely legal procedure. You will simply get up and go to the lavatory, and so become for a moment, so to speak, an ordinary member, while your colleagues discuss your request. All these are empty excuses that you've just thought up. How's your new novel? Asked the other. Is it nearly finished? But not talking about my novel now. I asked you very seriously to give your assent. We need young blood. Vishnevsky and I have given much thought to this list. Under no circumstances, said Fyodor, I don't want to play the fool. Well, if you call your public duty playing the fool, if I go on the committee, I shall certainly be playing the fool. So I'm refusing precisely out of respect for duty. Very sad, said Shirin. Will we really have to take Rostislav Stranyi instead of you? Of course, wonderful. I adore Rostislav. Actually, I had reserved him for the inspection committee. There's also Bush, of course. But do think it over, please. It's not a trifling matter. We shall have a regular battle with these gangsters. I'm preparing a speech that will really make them sit up. Think it over, do. You still have a whole month. During that month, Fyodor's book came out, and two or three notices had had time to appear, so that he set off for the general meeting with the pleasant feeling that he would find more than one enemy reader there. It took place, as usual, in the upper premises of a large café, and when he arrived, everybody was already there. A phenomenally dexterous waiter with darting eyes was serving beer and coffee. The members of the society were seated at little tables. The creative writers formed a close-knit group, and one could already hear the energetic psst, psst of Shakhmatov, who had been served the wrong order. In the back, behind a long table, sat the committee. The bulky, extremely gloomy Vasilyev, with Goryainov and Engineer Kern on his right, and the three others on his left. Kern, whose main interest was turbines, but who had once been on friendly terms with Alexander Blok, and the former official of a former government department, Goryainov, who could recite marvelously Woe from Wit, as well as Ivan the Terrible's dialogue with the Lithuanian ambassador, when he used to do a splendid imitation of a Polish accent, bore themselves with quiet distinction. They had betrayed long ago their three unrighteous colleagues. Of these, Gurman was a fat man with a bald head half occupied by a coffee-colored birthmark, massive sloping shoulders, and a disdainfully offended expression on his thick purplish lips. His relationship to literature was limited to a brief and entirely commercial connection with some German publisher of technical guides. The principal theme of his personality, the pith of his existence, was speculation. He was particularly keen on Soviet bills of exchange. Next to him sat a small but sturdily resilient barrister with a jutting jaw, a rapacious gleam in his right eye, the left one was half closed by nature, and a whole store of metal in his mouth. An alert, fiery man, something of a swashbuckler in his own way, who was always challenging people to arbitration. And he would talk of this. I called him out, he refused, with the precise severity of a hardened duelist. Gorman's other friend, loose-fleshed, gray-skinned, languid, wearing horn-rimmed spectacles, his whole aspect resembling a peaceful toad that wants only one thing, to be left in complete peace in a damp place, had somewhen, somewhere, written notes on economic questions. although the evil tongued Lishnevsky denied him even this, swearing that his sole printed effort was a letter in pre-revolution days to the editor of an Odessa newspaper, in which he had indignantly dissociated himself from a villainous namesake, who subsequently turned out to be his relative, then his double, and finally himself. As if there was in action here the irrevocable law of capillary attraction and fusion. Fyodor sat between the novelists Shakhmatov and Vladimirov by a wide window behind which the night gleamed wetly black, with two-toned, the Berlin imagination did not stretch to any more, illuminated signs, ozone blue and Oporto red, and rumbling electric trains with rapidly and distinctly lighted insides gliding above the square along a viaduct, against whose archivolts below slow grinding trams seemed to keep butting without finding a loophole. Meanwhile, the chairman of the board had stood up and proposed the election of a chairman for the meeting. There sounded from various places, "Kraevich, let's have Kraevich." And Professor Kraevich, no relation to the author of the textbook on physics, he was a professor of international law, a mobile, angular old man in a knitted waistcoat and unbuttoned jacket, swept up to the presidium table extraordinarily fast, holding his left hand in his trouser pocket and tossing up his pince-nez on the end of its cord with his right. He sat down between Vasiliev and Gurman, who was slowly and gloomily twisting a cigarette into an amber holder, immediately stood up again, and pronounced the meeting opened. "I wonder," thought Fyodor, glancing sideways at Vladimirov, "I wonder if he's read my book." Vladimirov put down his glass and looked at Fyodor, but said nothing. Beneath his jacket he was wearing an English sports sweater with a black and orange border along its triangular opening. The receding hair on either side of his forehead exaggerated the latter's dimensions. His large nose was strongly boned, his grayish-yellow teeth glistened unpleasantly beneath his slightly raised lip, and his eyes looked out with intelligence and indifference. He had studied, it seemed, at an English university and flaunted a pseudo-British manner. At 29, he was already the author of two novels, outstanding for the force and swiftness of their mirror-like style, which irritated Fyodor, perhaps for the very reason that he felt a certain affinity with him. As a conversationalist, Vladimirov was singularly unattractive. One blamed him for being derisive, supercilious, cold, incapable of thawing to friendly discussions. But that was also said about Koncheyev and about Fyodor himself, and about anyone whose thoughts lived in their own private house and not in a barrack room or a pub. When a secretary had also been elected, Professor Kraevich proposed that all should stand to honor the memory of the two deceased members of the society. And during this five-second petrification, the excommunicated waiter scanned the tables, having forgotten who had ordered the ham sandwich he had just brought in on a tray. Everyone stood as he could. Gurman, for example, his skew-bald head lowered, was holding his hand palm upwards on the table, as if he had just cast the dice and had frozen in astonishment at his loss. "Hallo, here!" shouted Shakhmatov, who had been waiting anxiously for the moment when, with a clatter of relief, life would be seated again. And then the waiter quickly raised his index finger, he had remembered, glided over to him, and with a tinkle put the plate down on the imitation marble. Shakhmatov immediately began to cut the sandwich, holding his knife and fork crosswise. On the edge of the plate, a yellow blob of mustard projected, as is usually the case, a yellow horn. Shakhmatov's complacently Napoleonic face, with its strand of steely blue hair slanting toward the temple, appealed particularly to Fyodor at these gastronomic moments. Next to him, drinking tea with lemon, and himself very lemony, with sadly arched eyebrows, sat the satirist from the Gazeta, whose pseudonym, Foma Moore, contained, according to his own assertion, a complete French novel, Femme Amour, a page of English literature, Thomas More, and a touch of Jewish skepticism, Thomas the Apostle. Shirin was sharpening a pencil over an ashtray. He was very much offended at Fyodor for refusing to figure in the election list. Of the writers, there were also Rostislav Stranyi, a rather dreadful person with a bracelet on his hairy wrist, the parchment-pale, raven-haired poetess Anna Aptekar, a theater critic, a skinny, singularly quiet young man with an elusive something about him recalling a daguerreotype of the Russian 40s, and, of course, kindly Bush, his eyes resting paternally on Fyodor, who, with half an ear cocked to the society president's report, had now transferred his gaze from Bush, Lishnevsky, Shirin, and the other writers to the general mass of those present, among whom were several journalists, as, for instance, old Stupishin, whose spoon was working its way through a wedge of mocha cake, many reporters, and, sitting alone and admitted here on God knows what basis, Lyubov Markovna in her timorously gleaming pince-nez. And in general, there was a large number of those whom Shirin severely termed the outside element. The imposing lawyer Charsky, holding his fourth cigarette of the night in his white, always trembling hand, a bearded little jobber who had once published an obituary notice in a Bundist paper, a gentle, pale old man tasting of apple paste, who enthusiastically discharged his duties as the precentor of a church choir, an enormous, enigmatic fat man who lived as a hermit in a pine wood near Berlin, some said in a cave, and had there compiled a collection of Soviet anecdotes, a separate group of rowdies, conceited failures, a pleasant young man of unknown means and position, a Soviet agent, said Shirin simply and darkly, another lady, someone's former secretary, her husband, the brother of a well-known publisher, and all these people, from the illiterate bum with a heavy, drunken gaze who wrote denunciatorily mystical verses which not a single newspaper had yet agreed to publish, to the repulsively small, almost portable lawyer Pashkin, who, when talking to people, said, "I pot for I put, and cushion for cushion," as if establishing an alibi for his name, all of these, in Shirin's opinion, damaged the society's dignity and were liable to immediate expulsion.